On Sunday, June 5th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl will feature composer and sax player Billy Harper. That's Sunday, June 5th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. As that promo stated, stay tuned for Sugar in My Bowl with me, Joyce Jones, and my guest, Billy Harper. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
just to let you know that you're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. What's playing in the background is Croquet Ballet from The Cookers, the latest from The Cookers, Cast the First Stone. And I didn't talk over the Billy Harper solo, but however, I am talking over the George Cables solo. And so on this CD, there is Billy Harper on tenor sax, of course, Eddie Henderson on trumpet, David Weiss on trumpet, Craig Handy on alto sax, George Cables, of course, on piano, Cecil McBee on bass, and Billy Hart on drums. And right now I'm sort of experiencing a little technical difficulty, waiting for something to happen, so hopefully I can get this together, and so we can hear the exchange that I had with Billy Harper, and also one of his fans, Joe Sloss, added some questions as well. It was sort of like his proxy interviewer. Anyway, this is WBAI New York, Sugar in My Bowl. Stay tuned. Ready. It's going to happen, but we can enjoy a little bit of this CD until it gets started. And so this is the title cut, Cast the First Stone. It's a Billy Harper composition, as was Croquet Ballet. Stay tuned. Well, thank you for joining Sugar in My Bowl at WBAI.
It's a pleasure being here.
Let's start at the beginning. The Black Church.
Oh, yeah.
What is your relationship?
Well, let's see. I just happened to be born into a family where my mother, I call her my mother, my grandmother was married to a minister. So I was in church every day.
Wow.
Either cleaning out the church or going to an extra meeting that she was going to, hanging out with her. You know, that's where the beginning of understanding about spirituality and music began. I was just around all those great singers. It was a fortunate thing. You know, just like whatever you hear anybody recording, like Aretha Franklin. Mm-hmm. I mean, some people like that singing. It was really something.
So you sang too.
It happened that, yeah, when I was very young, I was, well, before I was crawling, they said I was singing. So I was going to be a singer at first, I think. I was singing a lot and on all the programs on church. They would have a little kid up there.
Right.
and I sang with a choir, you know, small choir and the big choir when I got older. So I have the choir thing and the voices in my head. That's one good thing. I hadn't planned on doing anything like that myself. It turns out that in 2010 and 2011, I hear the voices stronger, and sometimes I do things with voices. In that church, there was so much rhythm. I mean, it was like being in Africa.
Mm, yeah.
I mean, organized musical event, and also the spirit was moving, you know. Mm. People would come out of the church dancing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I went to church as well, so. But when I was younger, they weren't really using drum kits at that time. So what were the instruments that
Had tambourines and the rhythm that the fellows were making with their feet and
right.
hands.
Right, right.
It was like a drum to
right.
me.
Right.
Know? All kind of rhythms happening.
So did they have a piano and organ?
Oh yeah, piano. No, they had. Well, in the first church, which when I was the smallest, I think it was just piano. But later, you know, there were pianos, organs, and everything.
Right.
But the music was really happening. It was simple, but just directly connected to Africa and African rhythms.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I never thought of it that way. Of course, you know, it was just my world, and that's what I heard. I heard things like stuff that James Brown was doing, and. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Ray Charles, but, I mean, it's just the soul part of it that was there. And, you know, of course, Ray Charles and a lot of the singers had trouble at the beginning trying to do their stuff because the church was against what they were doing.
Right, yeah. Right. And the church also had a problem with Mahalia Jackson after a while, which was really interesting.
Yeah.
So tell me, what did you sing when you were in church?
Oh, when I was small, I was singing soprano.
Oh.
I was really high. I was way up there. You know, I was that small. My voice hadn't changed yet. But when the voice started changing, then I kind of croaked out a few of the lower sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, I was just singing bass.
Oh,
you know?
Okay.
Yeah.
So when did you transition?
To saxophone?
Yeah.
Well, we're jumping up from the young ages, the little age, to 11. When
okay.
I was 11, I'd come from school, and I was just intrigued with the look of those horns, those things in the window at a shop, and I just stop and look and just stand there for the longest and look at those things. And I would look at all of them. One of them had three notes. It was a trumpet, I discovered later, but that's it. The three notes, that's not enough for me. All those other notes. What is that other thing? What is that with, man, all those notes? How can you do that? And I was counting fingers, and I had 10, and they had so many notes on there. I just looked at that, and so pretty soon I was seeing I had to have that horn. The fellow in the store called me in one day, finally, and introduced me to the horn and told me what it was. Yeah, and I said, saxophone. Man. Well, I was 10, I think, but by 11, at Christmas, I wanted a saxophone and a horse.
Where were you living in Texas?
No, you know, there was no space for a horse, but I was still, you know, little, and I wanted a horse.
Mm-hmm.
And
don't most 11-year-olds anyway?
Yeah.
A horse.
So, you know, I said, you can't have a horse. Where are you going to put a horse in? In the backyard, I said. That's some grass.
<You know?
laughs> But I ended up getting the horn, and it works out okay.
Yeah.
Fletcher's grandness, the heir to his big bands, was a master allowed to forever lay out the blue wonderfulness of the orchestra in Duke Ellington, whose greatness transcends all trends. Duke told Max, don't let them call your music jazz, because they can make anything that. What prophecy, cold and true? Why, they can say what your boy, what's-her-name, Elevator G is playing, is that you did? But then, what's-her-name was the king of jazz, and what's the other dude was the king of swing? And we now up to in that alley, banging on them tin pans, they called it swing, but they meant a noun, not a verb. Never could get the verb in. Remember all them ladies and men, masters and mistresses of the verbal thing, Ethel Waters in her blue new American classical popular song, and Billy, who reached the deepest tear in our heart, and Ella, all flying off them wonderful bands who carried our hearts, our meaning in their songs. The royalty like Duke and the Count of Basie, the lady who made her alliance with the real American president, Mr. Young, and you know they swung. Bean, the mighty hawk, taught us all how Lewis sounded on another horn. And the cats in their band, Duke's people at the top of the steeple, Johnny Hodges, Harry Carney, Cootie Williams, Cat Anderson, Paul Gonzales, Ben Webster, and other greats who morphed into another age. If the 20s was the jazz age, then the 30s, the Great Depression, people seemed like they got skinny. But the age of swing, from all those songs, the world was looking for love, but it seemed like there wasn't any. Goose-stepping in Europe, Paine in Spain. They was painting mustaches on the Mona Lisa and putting a commode in a museum. Had civilization stopped? My man Helene said they couldn't stop bebop, and they won't stop hip-hop. Bird blew, Dizzy knew, Max carried our original earth to this place where we grew. Bud smiled and here come mild. There was a B and a bop. It's just another beat, another B and another app. Where the is and the un-is cohabit the same frame. But the sound was a verb, not a noun, unless you could in Congo style really get down our share of shape. But then the could did, and then them original hipsters appeared with the Vance and the Bowie O'Rooney. Said, you gotta have them black notes, actually they is blue. I want my fifth flat. And you gotta have the drum where we and the music come from. Dig, that word was the first I heard. It all came beyond paper. For the proper syncopation, you gotta have improvisation. You're gonna take them tired chords and make our own songs, our own stories. Otherwise, it's too dull and don't swing. It ain't hip. We said we wanted wild, crazy, frantic. We wanted it to be exactly like us. Gone from the square world or out to lunch. My man Symphony said from the jazz corner of the world, it sounded like there was never anything before us. Hip as Birdland and this lullaby where I first heard the divine one. Sassy said, you're not that kind of a boy. You're not that kind of a boy. You're not that kind of a boy for a girl like me. What? And we heard of Fats Navarro and Fat Girl and Kenny Clark and Coog and Long Tall Dexter Gordon, Stan Getz and Zoot Sims. We heard the hippest people in the world. But remember, when you go out, somebody's gonna try to bring you back in. Bop was too hot, the anti-bop squad say. Too fast, too crazy. Crazy, we say. The counterattack was to bring it back. We'd all been out to lunch too long, whether it was swing or bebop. This is dream. If you wanted a cop, you had to hit the street. No road out of the jungle, that's 52nd Street. Where the Charleston hit the New York docks, 12th Avenue was a shock. From Angola to the gullahs in South Carolina, got the first thin smoke, went up to New York. Charleston, Jimmy P. wrote. Greet those who landed in the devil's northern house. Harold's Kitchen, to be exact. San Juan Hill, Monk and Vinnie Carter's home, where Lincoln Center sits still. That's right. He on the only money that ain't right. But what we was trying to say, when it got too hot, some folks ticked away from that street. I think it was the heat. Last seen heading west, they next addressed. It was cool, really cool. Some said, calm down. Miles said, get down. Stan heard, Clute, Budo, Jerry heard, Lee heard, John Lewis heard, Gil Evans heard, Pancho Higgins heard. They gave birth to the school, the real birth of the cool. When the memory of the hip starts to slip, the gorgeous blue, the funk we knew, they're gonna bend their knees and raise it back from the mood indigo that flows out of the black. What was bad could be bad. Much, much better than that. Thus spoke that. So when cool started to fool with my man JoJo's soul, he went out and put the church in. Where the Negro's eyes be rolling back in their head and start speaking some stuff ain't never been said. A dude named Buhana played them drums like he was insane. Up from the blue continent of dark under your heartbeat. Dudes named Horace drug the funky gospel into the joints, hollering, "Let me see what you do with your shovel." And the Holy Ghost popping his tambourine, chicka-ching, razzle in the room. That's nasty to bring Africa and the Lord in like that. He wanted the messengers from the Holy Ghost, Mau Mau Baptist Church, and they got a message from Kenyon, 125th Street. The University of Blakey, the Academy of, well, it might have seemed like that, but it really was business. Where you could dig Hank Mobley and listen nobly to the man who called the Underground King, Kenny Dorham. But always so many others came to fill up the space with names of that school, Clifford Brown, Ruth Allison, Chrissy D, Donald Byrd, Jack McLean, Lee Morgan, Benny Golson, all the way to Billy Harper and Wynton Marsalis. What all that was the saving of deep historical fonts, the blues, the ancient call and response from across the trees and through the woods, so you know where I am and I wait for your response. Our blue life memory all the way back across the world. The zigzag of chance, the improv, and fix, however, to the mighty drum, the rhythm of life. What has no beat cannot stay. What was called hard bop was something to wake us up again to the rhythm of ourselves. Max and Brownie, along with Bohena, helped bring the fire back. The post-cool smoke fanned from the wings of the great bird. But now the heavy motion would be by train. We call that band of Miles the Hydrogen Bomb and Switchblade Band. Paul and Red, Cannonball, the Funkus, Mad Philly Joe and Train, the Monster with the Horn. Actually, Miles' great band was but a preface to another awesome being. Trains, Corey Tyner, Jimmy Garrett, and Elvin Jones. The train had to pass through the sphere of Thelonious to get deep into the mysterioso of the funk, leaving the world of the merely hip for the monkishly profound. Monk and Train at the Five Spot opened the new world of Other Than Where You've Been. Let me tell you, I was there. Train didn't even know the arrangements. He sounded like a stranger. But in a minute, Train was in it, and the whole building moved and pulled away. Little Rudy Tootie jackying in Monk's mood. So around midnight, the new music came. We never was the same. By the time they got from the Bowery to Carnegie Hall, must have been time for something next stop new. Even a Pharaoh, an Ornette, an Albert, a Sun Ra fell by. They heard Train's cry. Monks blew inside. A new world welcomed those with ears.
On the subject of having the sax, you've been known to play a black saxophone. The color of the sax is black.
Yeah.
And actually, one of your fans, Joe Sloss. He has a question that says, it's very stylish, okay. The black sax.
Okay.
So how does style fit into your choice of clothing and stage presentation? Because he remembers seeing you in a black leather dashiki at one point. And now, you know, you are very stylish. But well, I understood that you had an interest in modeling.
Yeah, when I first got to New York. But, you know, the black thing is the black color and everything about that is a Capricorn thing. And black is a Capricorn color. And so my first album is Capra Black.
Right.
I mean, I recognized and realized how I was into the black color for a long time.
Okay.
I always liked the cowboys who had black, Hopalong Cassidy or Lash LaRue with a whip, black. That was my thing. So so I had a friend, Ted Dunbar, who encouraged me to, "Hey, man, your music is really floating out there. I mean, it's out there and it's in. You should look like that when you're playing." Mm-hmm. And so I decided, okay, I'll try to design something that goes with it. And it came out to be that that your friend saw.
The black dashiki.
Yeah, sort of like that. I call it Sikela.
Oh.
I sort of drew the design, and my girlfriend at the time made it in cloth.
Okay.
But then as we went along, I had others made, and then I started having one in leather, and then I had a lot in leather.
Okay.
And I still wear that with my group, not with other groups.
Right, right.
Yeah, so I don't want to stick out there.
Well, that means that I will be seeing it at some point.
You will. We're going to play at Smoke in August.
Oh,
first
okay.
First week of August, yeah.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah.
Keep that in mind, everybody. First week in August.
Mm-hmm.
It's Smoke.
My colors, basically, in my head, always would be black and silver. That's my whole thing.
Okay.
I've had a car that I called the Capra Blackmobile, which was all black. It had some silver rims or something. But really, I feel really comfortable in that color. And it sort of expresses a calmness and a power that I feel exactly like that. And it just happens to, I guess, it gets into areas of socio-political questions, I suppose, because I'm black and we have this culture of black and white in America. And I'm always having on the black, and I'm always talking about the politics and how the black musicians are sometimes ignored on purpose. So it makes it sound like I'm just talking about black for the sake of what, racial thing? Not really. I really like the color black, even if I were another race.
I understood your uncle set you up with gigs.
Yeah, well, he was the first one to, as soon as I got the horn, he had me over to his house, and we were listening to all of the very best jazz. And he was in high school with Kenny Dorham.
Oh, wow.
And he was playing trumpet with Kenny Dorham, but, you know, he didn't continue. And that's just high school. You know, Kenny Dorham went on to be the great KD.
Right.
He turned out being a lawyer, which is good, but... He was a musician at heart.
Oh, okay.
And he would make up words and things to spell the solos. So I was listening to Sonny Rollins, and he was having me listen and play all that, all the stuff at an early age. So I was listening to Kenny Dorham and Sonny Rollins. And he was the one who really spurred me on. Good, fresh start.
So did you hang on to Sonny Rollins as time went by, his style of playing? Or?
Well, I definitely love Sonny Rollins. Mm-hmm. But there were so many good saxophones in Houston, I call it. Houston. And so I was just inundated with all these sounds, big saxophone sounds, and Sonny Rollins had a big sound too. But there were some great players there. I mean, I was just lucky. I didn't know anything about the Texas tradition. You know, I didn't know there was a Texas saxophone tradition. But yeah, a lot of good players came from there, and not just Houston, also Dallas. When I went to college, I went to North Texas State, and I worked with James Clay, who was really one of my favorites. I had all kinds of inspiration with the saxophone.
Well, before we start talking about North Texas State University, what type of gigs did you have?
Oh, well, I was working. I had a really good ear. I could hear so well that I was working early. I was playing with the older cats, the blues guys, when I was 16, and just making a lot of money. And I thought I thought then I had to be a little professional at that time. But I was only 16, but I could play anything that I heard, and I was interested in whatever they played on the radio, I guess. Not enough jazz for me, but still, whatever, you know, those little solos were in the blues things, I played them on the gigs, and so, yeah, man, he can make the gig, he can do that. And I was just a little boy. But it did help me understand a whole lot about the blues, and I'm glad I went through that. But I was also making money, and I got a big head, you know, at early age, and I thought I could play anything, you know. And so by the time I got to North Texas, I can play anything.
did you consider dropping out of?
Yeah, at one time.
Yeah.
But I also got my head straightened out. You know, I heard a young lady playing piano. And she was playing some fantastic classical stuff on piano, all kinds of stuff. And I had to talk to her. I said, what are you doing? How do you do that? And here I am coming from Houston knowing everything, and I'm asking her. She said, well, I started playing when I was 3.
Wow.
And then I realized how far behind I was. And I stopped singing. I stopped doing drama, acting, and anything. Everything else but just trying to master the horn.
Wait a minute. You were acting?
I was doing that too. Yeah. And in high school, my favorite person was Vernell Lilly. We still are in touch with each other. And her husband played saxophone. He was a great saxophonist too.
Huh.
Richard Lilly. We call him Dickie Boy.
Okay.
And I was called a Lilly Boy. Her people were a little into the art. So we were like Lilly Girls and Lilly Boys. You know, Michael Carvin was also in the band when I was there at high school.
Really?
At high school, yeah.
Oh, wow.
He was a drummer when I was leading the band, the high school marching band.
You were leading the high school marching band.
Leading the high school marching
band. So you just throw that in.
Like, yeah.
How did you wind up leading the high school marching band?
Well, you know, I was advanced as a you know, music student, and the instructor, professor, had some advanced students lead the band from time to time. Yeah. By the time I got junior or something, I was leading the band.
Give you an idea of what you've been hearing. Oh my goodness, what is going on in here?
Okay, that's what's happening. All right, that's better. Woo! All right, so this is Sugar My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones. You're listening to an exchange between myself and Billy Harper. What you're listening to right now is 17 Bar Blues from John and Billy. It is a 1993 release on Evidence Records. John Faddis and Billy Harper. John Faddis on trumpet, Billy Harper on tenor sax, whom I'm speaking over right now. Roland Hanna on piano, George Morantz on bass, and Motohiko Hino on drums. All right. Before that, we heard Knowledge of Self. And this is Billy Harper recording on Blueprints of Jazz, Volume 2. Released in 2008 on Talking House Records. That is indeed Amiri Baraka. Where our stuff come from? Where our stuff come from? Part 2. That's what we were listening to. His lyrics, his words. Amiri Baraka's words, and Billy Harper's composition. Francesca Tanksley on piano, Aaron Scott on drums, Kenyon Harold on trumpet, and Clarence C. on bass, and Louis Spears on bass as well. Of course, Billy Harper on tenor. And here's John Faddis. This was probably the time for me to let you know what you were listening to. But this is WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM. Before that, when we were waiting for the conversation to start, we were listening to a couple of cuts from Cast the First Stone, the latest recording from The Cookers, sort of collective that Billy Harper is working with right now, and we'll share with you later. Share information about that later. So stay tuned. This is Sugar My Bowl on WBAI New York 99.5 FM.
Texas State University, yeah, which is now, what, University of North Texas?
Yes, UNT.
Yeah. I understood you were...
The first black person in that band. In the number one band.
Yes.
That band is, wow. And they're still fantastic. So 1 o'clock band.
Right.
Yeah. At that time, North Texas had five big bands. Five big bands. That was a lot.
Wow. That is a lot.
Yeah. So you had to work yourself up. Of course, the whole band was white, and most of those fellows were professionals in that 1 o'clock band. They played with Woody Herman and Stan Kenton and that kind of
stuff.
Wow. Yes.
Okay.
And then they were so young, young enough to come back to school and be in, and that was the 1 o'clock band.
Right. Wow.
Yeah. When I got there, I worked really hard. You know, I was sort of the mad saxophonist or the mad practicer or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, I practiced. I really did practice. One semester, I just stopped going to classes and just practiced.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I was really into it.
How did you make it into the next semester having stopped going to classes?
I don't know how I did it at that time, but I had to practice more, you know. I want to master this horn. And so whatever I was doing before just wasn't enough. I was just hearing and playing. I mean, you know, I played some marches and stuff like that, but... No, to really get into that horn is a whole different level. And I just didn't even know that.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
So how'd you get into the band?
Well, I played. I was practicing so much. And I was playing a whole lot of difficult stuff. And it was obvious that when everybody passed the room, they could hear, wow. They were probably hearing the way I was hearing with that lady playing the piano. They said, wow, how did he do that? And that happened for a long time, but the head of the jazz department was a little hesitant, was rather hesitant about, you know, integrating the band, I think. But we had some fellows in that band who probably were talking and saying, look, you can't just leave him out of the band, not with him playing like that, you know. And so pretty soon I got into the 1 o'clock band.
Excellent.
Yeah.
They let you solo?
Oh, yeah. Oh, that was, yeah, my forte.
Right. So how was it being with the other bandmates?
Well, you know, the fortunate thing is that a lot of the people in the 1 o'clock band were from New York.
Ah! All right!
That's right. You know, so for them, that Texas thing was kind of new, too. Mm. It was easy during that time to clash with one of those Confederate guys or something. You know, they had a Confederate fraternity or something there. And... at the school, there were 10,000 people, 10,000 students, but 100 blacks, only 100.
Huh.
So, you know, it was during the time of sit-ins and all that, and we started an integration movement and went through the whole thing, you know, the marching and sitting in.
You participated in
that? Yeah. Yep. Went through all of it. It took the longest time for them to integrate the campus because when I got there, we were staying across the tracks, of course, in this small... Denton, across its tracks, where all the blacks stayed. And so that's where we were. And so we had to walk every morning a long way just to get to school.
Mm.
Some football guys had cars.
Oh, okay.
But then they filled their cars with some of the other football guys, and then the other people had to walk. Mm. We had to walk through the graveyard and through the so-and-so, and way over there to the main little town of Denton.
Wow.
Yeah. Pretty soon after... A little while, they integrated some of the girls' dorms, and so some of the ladies were there, and they had to go through their little troubles, too. And shortly after that, they slowly tried to start it with the fellows. Some of the sports guys were in the dorms, but they would mainly open up the houses, the apartments, for rent.
Mm.
So we started with the apartments being opened up. And sometimes we'd wake up and there's a big light out there in the front of the thing, and we'd run to the front, and then across the street was a burning cross.
Oh, goodness.
So, wow. Yeah, we had to go through a lot of stuff.
Thank you. you were able to leave the place, what did you leave with and where did you go?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because I was working regularly with James Clay at in Dallas. I went to Dallas and stayed there, and I was just working on the weekends there. When you graduate, they give you a little card, a gas card, you know, a free gas card, so that you can use it, but you have to pay them back.
Mm.
And, you know, some students didn't do that. I don't think I did it very much either, but I know that when I got near the end of the card, I had only 3 days left on the card. 3 days of gas, and I said, and I didn't have any money, so I thought, I better get out now. And that's when I left.
Oh, my gosh.
That's when I left Dallas to go to New York.
Oh, my goodness.
I borrowed $100 from a friend there. That's the way I came to New York.
Excellent.
Mm.
So tell me about your experience once you got in New York.
Yeah. Well, for one thing, the first night I stayed at the President Hotel, I think, in Midtown. And but that was eating up the money. It wasn't expensive in general, but for me it was. So I had to get out the next day, and then I was driving around looking for something. And it got late, but I happened to accidentally pass this place where Thelonious Monk was playing.
Wow.
And down the street, McCoy Tyner was playing.
Oh, wow.
And I said, wow. I said, yeah, oh, wow. And I had all my clothes in the car, everything. And a friend was with me also, and I said, well, let me just run in here for a second. We'll run in, and I grabbed my horn just, and I had on jeans, and at that time I never wore jeans because I was into the modeling thing.
You know? Right, right.
But I ran in to hear Monk just for a few minutes, and then I ran to hear McCoy across the street down the way, and when I came back, everything was gone.
Including the car?
The car was there, but the windows were down, and everything else was gone. And I did have my horn.
Right.
So that was my introduction to New York.
Oh.
It's like on the Living Color, those fellows say, here's my car. Bam! New York said, here's my car. Bam!
When you felt ready to play, you know, when you know, you're in New York, who did you want to play with?
But when I was ready, mm-hmm. I was really ready at 19.
Yes.
Yeah, and
yes.
I did leave school.
Oh, okay.
One time. Thinking that, okay, maybe I should go to New York. No. And I went with a friend of mine who is a good guitar player out there. And we came, and even during then, I was able to... I was ready, and I sat in with Horace Silver's group.
Wow.
Horace was not there, but Junior Cook and all the others were there.
Okay.
Harold Mabin was playing piano.
Excellent.
But the family was always trying to get me to definitely finish school. You've got to finish school, you know. So I said, oh, man. I went back to school.
Right.
And I said, I don't know what. But it did turn out that I did learn something. I did learn how to write for big band.
Mm.
I was not interested. I was not really quite interested in big band.
Mm-hmm.
But it turned out that I played with a lot of big bands.
Right.
In my own career in New York. So I learned something else. There's always something to learn.
Right.
I've learned that there's always something to learn. So I went back and finished school.
But once you were here, who did you want to play with? Who else did you want to play with? Since you've already played with...
Yeah, you know, when I was in high school, I had a band that we played all of Art Blakey's stuff even then.
Mm.
And let's see. You know that Red Garland was from Dallas also.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
I discovered that later before leaving.
Yeah.
But Red Garland told me, hey, man, wow, you play good. I'm going to get you a job with Miles, he said. I was not necessarily interested, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. but he said, I'm going to get you a job with Miles.
Mm-hmm.
But Red, when I came to New York, he was always in Philadelphia somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Or back in Texas.
Oh, my gosh.
I was sitting in with everybody and anybody.
Oh.
Yeah, all the time, every night.
Wow.
Yeah, I'd be out every night until 4 o'clock in the morning. And I ended up meeting Kenny Dorham,
mm-hmm.
finally.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't remember my uncle, but he said, oh, yeah, he knew that he was in school in Austin, Texas at that time.
Okay.
It turned out that with all my clothes stolen, I was going out in the blue jeans every night, looking the way I'd not have looked then.
Mm-hmm.
But I got used to it. It's more like New York. You know, I was surprised when I met Gil Evans. He had on jeans, and I thought, wow. Because I had seen him on the cover of Out of the Cool and all that
right,
stuff.
Right, right, exactly.
Yeah, Gil was so casual, just jeans and you know, T-shirt or something.
Huh.
So I learned how to not be so attached to those material things after they were stolen, though.
Right.
And the other good part of the story is that after all those things were stolen, I didn't know anybody. Well, I had heard that Cedar Walton was from Dallas, and I went back into the club. I saw him in the club, and I said, "Oh man, I just went out there and all my stuff was stolen." And he said, "Well, you shouldn't have left it there."
Where's this compassion?
Yeah, none of the guys in Texas were like that. Okay, so I knew nobody, and I was looking in the phone directory for people. I don't know. But then I did remember that Diddy Moffitt, who played with Ornette Coleman, was possibly in New York. And I found his number and called him, and he saved me.
Oh, wow. So you stayed with Diddy Moffitt.
Stayed with Diddy, yeah.
Nice.
Charles Moffitt.
Yes.
We called him Diddy.
Excuse me. Yes, I was like, okay.
Yeah. We called him Diddy in Texas. Now, well, Diddy, drums always said something about Diddy Boom.
Oh,
Diddy
okay.
Boom. Yeah.
Okay.
So, Diddy was a drummer, and he was playing Diddy Boom a lot of drums.
Well, speaking of drums, do you have an affinity with drums?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Yes. That was quite apparent, and that made it easy for me to make it in New York, because when I was doing all that hard practicing, I'd just take a break on the saxophone and jump on the drums to try to play.
Wow.
And so I learned a little bit about the drums. And then when I got to New York, I really knew how to play with the drummers.
Uh-huh.
So I think they all like me.
Oh, okay.
It was easy. Yeah. So as soon as I first worked with Gil Evans. I met him on the street, and I said, "Wow, Gil Evans, I'm Billy Harper, and I'm from Texas. I really love your music. If you ever need a saxophonist for rehearsal or anything, just give me a call." Mm-hmm. He said yes, and we exchanged cards. But that's musicians always exchange cards and means nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not going to call you. But after about 6 months or something, I did get a ring.
Wow.
When I was really quite despondent, about to give up, lying across the bed. And the phone rang, and they said it was Gil Evans.
Wow.
And he called me for rehearsal. That went great.
Very quickly, you're listening to Sir Galahad from Capra Black, Billy Harper's first release as a leader, 1973 on Strata East, Billy Harper on tenor sax, George Cables on piano, Jimmy Owens, oh God, I'm so not prepared, Julian Priester on trombone, and Elvin Jones on drums. That's who we're listening to right now. Before that, we heard Dance, Eternal Spirits Dance, from Black Saint, 1975 release on the Black Saint label, Billy Harper Quintet, Billy Harper on tenor, and cowbell, Virgil Jones on trumpet, Joe Bonner on piano, David Friesen on bass, and Malcolm Pinson on drums, and I'll get my head straight and let you know what Jimmy Owens is doing. This is WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM.
Story about Elvin before Gil Evans. This is when I was trying to sit in with everybody. I went to Elvin's gig and he was playing with Hank Mobley. And the first night I went in there, I said, "Mr. Jones, I'm Billy Harper and from Texas, and I'd like to sit in with you if possible." And the first thing that came out of his mouth was, "No!" It was that hard too. And I didn't know anything about what was happening there, but Elvin was looking at me like this, and
was he snarling?
Yeah. But yeah, I knew about the drug problems and stuff, but I didn't know where he was. I didn't, you know, at that time he was just always drunk, and I didn't really know, you know. But I said, "Yes, sir. Okay, goodbye." You know, and I came back the next night. I was really ready. I knew I was ready.
Right.
Nobody else did, but I did. And I said, "Well, Elvin, Mr. Jones, I wonder if I can sit in tonight." He said, "No!" But it wasn't as hard, you know, but it was still enough to throw you off.
Right.
And I said, okay. And then I heard that he was having a rehearsal the next day. And I went to this rehearsal before time, and he pulled up in a taxi, and then when he was getting out, I said, "Mr. Jones, I'll help you with the drums if you let me sit in." He said, "Oh, no, don't do that. Don't do that to me. Don't do that." Okay, but anyway, I helped him with the drums upstairs, and I got a chance to hear this rehearsal, which was great. Mm-hmm. And then after it was over, I helped him with the drums downstairs.
Uh-huh.
And I came that night to the gig and said, you think I might be able to sit in tonight?" He said, "Oh, go sit down. Just sit down. Maybe on a third set or something."
But it's changing. It's getting better.
Yeah, yeah. So I sat down, and I waited until the third set, and third set came and went, and I was just sitting there alone. Everybody was going home. Okay, but you know, I had my fortitude together, and I came the next night after that. Perhaps I was a little insane, but it was a good insanity at that time.
Yeah,
because Elvin seemed insane to me when he was talking. So I came in and asked again. Mm. You know, "I'm bothering this Elvin Jones," but I didn't care. He said, "All right, yeah, okay, on the third set." No, everything was very different then. It was third set. You know, this is almost definite.
Right, right.
I'm sitting down, waiting. Third set came. Everybody went home. I'm still...
Wow.
I came the next night again.
Uh-huh.
I didn't ask a word. I didn't say a thing. I just looked at him and then just went and sat down.
Oh.
Yeah, just shut up and sat down. It happened to be the last night, so maybe it was easier to happen. But as the third set came up, he looked over there and called me up.
Oh.
Yeah. So sometimes it's good not to be so pushy.
Hmm.
So I came up, and as soon as I came up, he jumped off the drums, and Philly Joe jumped on.
Uh-oh.
Philly Joe started playing something really fast. And, you know, really cocky. Billy Joe's cocky guy.
Uh-huh.
And so Hank played, you know, and he's one of the guys, and he can play.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's time for... the other guy didn't really play because that's too fast for him. But I was ready, and it was time for me, so I came in playing. And Philly was playing. And by the time I started just a little bit, not even half the solo... All of a sudden, he hits the snare drum, boom, and puts his elbow down, and everybody stopped and looked at me.
Oh. Oh, my gosh.
I'm the only one playing.
Oh, my gosh.
I didn't know what was happening. I just kept playing. Yeah, I just kept playing. You know, nobody prepared me for any of this stuff.
Right.
I just had to go on intuition. I just kept playing anyway. And then I just closed them out and just played. And then pretty soon the audience was applauding.
Hmm.
And then he had to come in. When he came in, they were really screaming, "Yeah!" And so I made it.
Excellent. Wow. Yeah. That was your coming out party.
My breakthrough, for sure.
Right.
After I came off the stage and Philly was standing up there, he said, "You know, you play good, but you play so long." So that was just a test. And then from that moment, things did seem to change. I think, you know, the word might have spread and they might have heard about that. And slightly after I met Gil, and we went to California to play, and Elvin was on drums.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it turned out great, you know, and then we got to know each other. And also, shortly after the thing started with Gil, Blakey heard about me or something and said, "Come down to the Village Gate" at the time. So I came down, and I had my suit on and everything, and I was playing, and after I finished, I had the gig.
Wow.
Yeah. But, you know, I was going to say before, I had an Art Blakey group in Houston. I mean, we played Blakey stuff, so I knew all the stuff. And I knew how to play with the drummer.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was a really good thing.
Yeah.
And Blakey really liked that, you know.
Oh, that's great.
So I was working with Art Blakey.
Now, this was while you were still with Gil Evans?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because sometimes, you know, the groups don't always work.
Right.
Yeah. And Gil was not, at that time, was not even going to Europe. And somewhere in between there, you know, I worked with Elvin also.
Mm-hmm. You recorded with all of them.
Yes. You know, everything kind of overlapped at one time with Gil Evans, at the same time Art Blakey.
Okay.
At the same time Donald Byrd.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
I forgot about him, yeah.
Wow.
And shortly after that, also with Lee Morgan.
Yes.
Yeah.
Talking through this song because I love it so much. This is Capra Black, which is actually the Lee Morgan version from Lee Morgan, The Last Session, 1971 on Blue Note label. As I mentioned before, we had heard Sir Galahad. Jimmy Owens, by the way, is a trumpeter, so pardon me, old heads, where, you know, I lost my way and I couldn't think straight. I'm juggling things in here. So let's listen to this for a moment. I'll let you know who's on here later. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. All right. You're listening to Sugar My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones. And I've been having an exchange with Billy Harper. It is on recording, so he is not here. Just so you know, what you just heard was the Billy Harper version of Capra Black. Before that, you heard the Lee Morgan version of Capra Black on the, you know, sort of mixed it up to buy me some time. On the Billy Harper version of Capra Black, you heard George Cables on piano, Reggie Workman on bass, Julian Priester on trombone. don't think Dick Griffin's on this one, on trombone. Billy Cobham on drums, for certain. Let's see. Well, actually, no, I can't say. Warren Smith is on drums as well. Jimmy Owens on trumpet. And, before that we heard the Lee Morgan version of Capra Black from the last sessions. I tell you, I have had quite the week. As a matter of fact, for those who may not know, the Vision Festival started today. It's at, Abrams, on the Abrams Art Center on Grand Street. Yes! Excuse me, trying to get the last half of the show to you. And it's the Vision Festival. If you go to visionfestival.org, you'll be able to you'll be able to get more information on that. And unfortunately, with everything that I was doing this week, I wasn't able to go today. I'm not happy. I wanted to go so badly. But there's more to be seen. And stay tuned. This is Sugar My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones. And Joe Sloss, your questions are coming. That is with Lee Morgan.
Yeah.
You were involved in the what was referred to as the last session.
Well, yeah, it is the last session.
And a couple of your compositions were featured.
Yeah, yeah.
How did you get that break?
Well, Lee was very progressive, and he wanted to do some new things.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, he was trying to change his life. He wanted to do everything new, and
mm-hmm.
he loved Capra Black.
Uh-huh.
So that was one of the main things that we played, and also croquet ballet.
Yes.
Yes.
That's the one I love.
Yeah. Yeah.
As well.
Yeah. We played that together the first time at Howard University, and it was just a hit right away. He loved those two tunes, and that's how we got the recording, had that done.
Nice.
Yeah. And people still remember that From Lee's album more than mine.
You know, it's interesting. Somebody had asked me about, because I had heard, actually from the Cookers,
mm-hmm.
I had heard Croquet Ballet, and somebody had asked me, Lee Morgan's? I was like, no, I actually think it's from the Cookers, but...
It's also from one of my albums.
From...
my first one, Capra Black.
Exactly.
And also, Art Blakey liked it, so I played it with him also. Mm-hmm. So somewhere in there... An overlapping thing had happened, and I was also working with that Jones Mel Lewis
big
band.
Right. We'll be right back.
good that I learned big band stuff in college, because I was also ready for them.
Yeah.
But I don't think I would have been if I hadn't checked out the 1 o'clock band.
Yeah. So I want to go back to Gil Evans, because we didn't really spend too much time with him, talking about him.
Yeah.
I guess he was trying new things as well.
Yeah.
And he recorded some of your songs
yeah.
as well.
Oh, yeah. Yes. One of the main ones that he liked was Thoroughbred, which I never played. I haven't played with my group. It's kind of, to me, it was a little commercial style. You know, he played that with a backbeat. I just don't play with my group.
Uh-huh.
But also Priestess.
Yes.
Yes. And that's one of the, that's one of the main ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I should let you know that if you've missed any information, that you can email me at sugar, S-U-G-A, in my bowl, at gmail.com. That's sugar, S-U-G-A, in my bowl, at gmail.com. Back to the juggling. This is Sugar in My Bowl. Stay tuned.
On one of those.
Which one do you think actually was probably the most adventurous of the Gil Evans recordings that you participated in?
The entire record or just the composition, the tunes?
The entire record. Yeah, the recorded date.
Could have been Svengali. Did you? Yeah.
Yeah, I was looking at that one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, might have been. But I liked all of the albums he recorded when I was there with him.
What did you think about the Jimi Hendrix one? The Gil Evans Orchestra plays the music of Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah. I think that Gil was a little influenced by some of the things that Miles was doing at the mm-hmm. time. And so I think that's probably how that it got around to that. Right. But, yeah, we did that one too. Gil plays Jimi Hendrix, yes.
Yeah, that was like 75, mm-hmm. apparently.
Mm-hmm. Before you were born.
No, it isn't. Actually, I want to go back to the Lee Morgan recording.
Mm-hmm.
He used two basses. He used Jimmy Merritt and he used Reggie Workman.
Yeah. That was a good... that was different, eh?
Yeah, what was that? When I remember reading it. I said, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, he was doing new things. You
okay,
know?
And,
well, you know, Lee came up in Philadelphia with all the same cats. They were, right. I think, at the similar high schools.
Right.
McCoy, Tyner, and Lee Morgan,
right.
and Reggie Workman,
right. and Jimmy Merritt.
Jimmy Merritt. Yeah, all of them were sort of hooked together.
Right.
Bill Cosby, too, was around.
Yeah, rumor has it he played drums.
He wants to play drums.
Yeah, he wants to play drums.
Yeah, he plays a little. You know, and Mickey Rocco was there.
Mm.
Now, he and Mickey were good friends, I think. And uh-huh. Mickey Rocco is just a natural, funny guy.
Mm.
You know, he's a drummer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
And Bill is wants to be a drummer, and he's the funny guy.
Right.
But, well, you know, he's a little drummer in his own right, I'd say.
Yeah.
But Mickey was a natural comedian. Mm. It's funny how things turn out, because he could have been a real comedian. But, of course, Cosby's funny.
Yeah, that was a very adventurous recording.
Yeah. Well, Train used two basses on something, mm-hmm. Ole or something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I have used two basses on one of the albums. Also, I've used two drummers simultaneously.
Well, Coltrane did as well.
Oh, yeah.
He used Rashid Ali and Elvin Jones. The way it was engineered is like on the left channel it was
mm-hmm.
one and on the right channel it was the other.
Yeah.
So. Capra Black.
Mm-hmm.
That was your first recording as a leader, huh?
Right. That was it. And as we started talking about the values and the qualities of the color black and what it meant in relation to my presentation, I suppose, or the way that I saw things, the way I saw life, I had a real thing, and I still do. I'm like, well, yeah.
Right, you're in black. He's wearing black people for those who can't see.
Yeah. But, you know, I can't walk around all the time in black. I mean, you know, people...
You don't?
Well, I almost do.
Yeah.
You know how certain colors have certain qualities mm-hmm. and stuff. I consider myself kind of calm and mm-hmm. reserved, and I feel the power.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I just feel, and I feel stronger when I have my colors on. You know.
Well, I certainly hear it in your compositions.
Good.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Too.
That's good.
your compositions are, they're very moving, emotionally moving. It's very energized.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand your method of composing is whether you feel something while you're doing it.
Yeah, that those things that I finally come out that out with that you say are energizing are the ones that that I've waited for. I mean, I learned how to write in school a certain way. I don't really write that way. I mean, the way they teach you in school. Mm-hmm. I just wait. If I'm trying to write something, I'll wait until the right thing comes by inspiration. Mm-hmm. So while waiting, sometimes I get 7 or 8 fairly nice ideas, mm-hmm. but they don't feel as energizing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just wait until that one comes.
Wow.
when it comes, I know that somebody's going to feel it because I feel it.
Yeah.
And I have to play it about, it seems like I play it 100 or something times, you know.
Sure. Oh, what is it about, this is another one of Joe's, actually we were on the same page with this, Joe and I want to know, what is it about the formation of a quintet? Because you tend to have that formation more.
Yeah. Regularly. Sometimes sextet, but basically quintet.
Mm-hmm.
I think it felt so comfortable, and the music felt so good when I was playing the Art Blakey stuff. That's what I ended up hearing mostly. I hear 5,
mm-hmm.
you know. I mean, that's sort of a balance for me. It's because of the coloring. You can color that way. It can be exciting enough with one horn, but or with a trio. I've never really played with a trio. I could do that. Maybe that would be different. But I hear another horn, and I hear the saxophone in relation to a trumpet.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm listening for that kind of force, that kind of power. So I probably play somewhere connected to that on my horn, but I also want to hear it
mm-hmm.
with another horn.
Right.
Yeah. It's like some musicians can hear themselves playing solo.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. That never struck me so much. I mean, I could do that, and I've played one song like that, but, you know, I don't feel it as much.
Also, on Capra Black, you revisited Voices.
Oh, yeah. You know what? No, I'm glad you brought it up, because I did say that later on. I got back to the voices that were in my head. You know, good voices.
Yes.
But it's a funny thing. Believe it or not, you know, I did hear the choirs and all those voices when I was little, but I was really impressed all the time when I heard the beginning of Amos and Andy, those voices, the voices that was their theme song.
Uh-huh.
It was a choir.
Huh.
And it just stuck in my head. I love those voices.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's a funny thing.
So you brought them on to Capra Black.
I brought them on to Capra Black.
And Gene McDaniels was one of those voices.
Yep, Gene McDaniels. You know, he wrote some words to some of the songs that I've written. I wrote also some songs that were sort of in a commercial format also, but I didn't play them.
Like what?
Thoroughbred is one that Gil played.
Right, right.
And
Gene McDaniel wrote words to Thoroughbred?
Yeah, he did. One time by Grady Tate.
What?
Yeah, but the song, when he sang it, is called I Can Deliver.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I like Billy Cobham, right. But I was just thrilled to have Elvin on there.
Yeah, he was on as well. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, Billy Cobham was on also, and he and I played with some people before he got famous, before he was known as the Billy Cobham.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Did they play together?
No.
Oh,
no.
Okay. Yeah.
On separate tracks.
That's funny.
Warren Smith was also on.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Another fabulous drummer.
That's right.
It's amazing.
Yeah. So, yeah, I have... this special thing with the drummers, you know,
mm-hmm.
I like. In fact, I think I'm going to do something. I go to Poland often, at least once a year. I'm going next time with three drummers.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
We're going to set it up so that they are featured. But definitely we're going to play with three drummers.
Wow.
And that's going to be different. Well, this will be three of the well-known drummers from here, from New York.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. Kappa Black was on the Strata East label.
Yes.
How did you wind up signing
with them?
Yeah, Strata East.
Well, Strata East was a very avant-garde style record company, and it was owned by artists. It was a great idea, you know. The artists who recorded got most of the percentage of the record, which was a new thing.
Right.
And it was just wonderful if we could have just kept it going. A lot of the black musicians who were not being recorded on the name labels also had a chance to record on Strata East.
Yeah.
It was a very good project. It's a lot of work, mm-hmm. you know, but the main part of the work went to Charles Tolliver and Stanley Cowell. Maybe somebody will have the energy to try that again.
Yeah.
So
it was good for you, being on Strata East?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Sure. We'll be right back.
Now it's time to talk about the three-volume live on tour in the Far East.
Yeah.
Those recordings. And at this point, I'd like to thank Newman Taylor Baker for helping facilitate this exchange.
Yes. Oh, good. Yes. I have to thank Newman Taylor Baker, too, for being such a great drummer with me for the longest time. You know, I think we started playing together in 1980.
Wow.
And he drummed with me for most of the years that I've played and recorded. Aaron Scott is on drums now, but... Newman was there through all the thick and thin of it, you know. And he's a great drummer.
So tell me about, there were three volumes to this.
Yeah. What happened is that we were doing a tour of the Far East. Mm-hmm. And I thought of the idea that we're going to be in so many places. There's so many opportunities to play on this tour that we may as well record some of it, you know. So I took an engineer who could record us.
Okay.
We ended up recording something in Korea. It's hard for me to remember now, but I think one place was Korea, and another was Kaohsiung, Taiwan.
Okay.
And, another place over there in the Far East. So volume 1, 2, and 3. Mm-hmm. And we had a chance to record as long as we play.
Wow.
So it's and that's why it took 3.
Okay.
Volumes, you know.
Yeah. I figured when I saw this, like, oh, it must have been a lot of material.
Yeah, it was really a lot of material. And it was a great trip.
And Newman Taylor Baker is on
it. Newman Taylor Baker
during
is on
tour. Newman. Who else?
It was Francesca Taxley on piano and Clarence C. I think Clarence is on bass. Well, on that one, it was Louis Spears,
okay.
I think, on that tour. Louis and I played together in Texas. He's from Oklahoma.
Wow.
Yeah, but we played together in Texas before I ever came up here. He was playing with James Clay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And he's been in California for the longest now, living there. Eddie Henderson, trumpet. Mm. Yeah.
A long relationship.
Yeah.
That series was recorded on Steeplechase. How's your relationship with Steeplechase?
Let's see. I only did that particular project with them. Yes, I didn't really... With most of the companies, I didn't continue to just record for that company. Mm-hmm. You know, I sort of stayed a little free.
Okay.
And it's been like that with most of the companies.
Okay. The Great Friends recording.
Yeah.
There are two. Yeah. There was Such Great Friends, right. Which was originally recorded in 1983.
Hmm.
And it was released in 1991
yeah.
for whatever
yeah.
reason.
Yeah.
And you have two compositions on there, Destiny Is Yours and...
Well, it's another one, I think. But, yeah, we recorded that. And also Great Friends, the Great Friends one.
Right.
We were traveling a lot as a group then.
Oh, okay.
You know, sort of, you could think of it sort of like the Cookers, but we were called the Great Friends.
Okay. And let's see, Such Great Friends was apparently recorded on Strata.
Yeah.
Strata East. Mm-hmm. And the Great Friends was on Evidence.
Yes.
And that was released in 1986.
Mm-hmm.
And on Great Friends, you have Insight.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The longest title I've ever seen. Is it not true simply because you cannot believe it?
Yeah, well. Yeah. Is it not true simply because you cannot believe it?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah, think of it.
Yeah. Okay, because of all of the technical stuff, I have to sort of draw this to a close. There's probably about, quite a few minutes left on this. And it would be nice if I could play the rest of it some other time. But, there's another show. There's the next show. Maybe I can play 10 minutes of it next time I'm back, which is the 19th, where I hope my guest will be Jimmy Merritt and his son Mike. Let's see. What we've been hearing is... what did we hear? Oh, Fingers. Thad Jones and Mel Lewis, big man from Consummation, and we heard it was an exercise in dexterity, so we heard Billy Harper exercising his dexterity, along with Thad Jones and Mel Lewis. This is a 1970 Blue Note release. Priestess is, actually, let me do this, because I actually don't want to...
It's sort of...
Yeah, that's what I want to avoid. Let's do this. Yeah. Not good. We're listening to the first Cookers release in the background. It's actually a Freddie Hubbard song, The Core. So, apropos. For the Cookers, anyway. Alright, so... Priestess is what we heard after Fingers. Billy Harper from In Europe, 1979 Soul Note release. Billy Harper on tenor sax, Horace Arnold on drums, Fred Hirsch on piano, Everett Hollins on trumpet, and Louis Spears on bass. And then we heard Let All Voices Sing from Soul of an Angel. You know... I start packing up, and I don't have what I need. But this was a 2000 Metropolitan Records release, and we have Billy Harper on tenor, A.V. Henderson on trumpet, Francesca Tanksley on piano, Louis Spears on bass, and Newman Taylor Baker on drums. And let's see, after that we heard... the theme from Amos and Andy, the Jeff Alexander... Orchestra and chorus. Some interesting stuff there. I vaguely remember that theme. I wasn't around when it was actually on, but I knew it would spook the heck out of me when I was a kid. So anyway, the song, the theme did. But in any event, there you have it. An inspiration for Billy Harper. And we heard Thoroughbred, Gil Evans. From his version of Thoroughbred from Svengali. This is Billy Harper's composition. Svengali has... what does he have? Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
It has Billy Harper on tenor sax. David Sanborn's on here as well on one of these recordings. Oh, and Howard Johnson, who will eventually be a guest of mine, Nedra Johnson's father, will be a guest at some point. Anyway, I can deliver was after that. Grady Tate from After the Long Drive Home, a 1969 Sky Records release. Words written by Dee McDaniel. Music by Billy Harper. Soren Bushi B.H. from the Billy Harper Quartet this time. Billy Harper, tenor sax. Eddie Henderson, trumpet. Francesca Tanksley on piano. And either Louis Spears. Well, Louis Spears on bass. Why does it say quartet? That's not a quartet. Anyway, this is the lineup they gave me. That's what they say, and they call it, oh, it's a quintet, I just miswrote it, that's what it was. Anyway, Louis Spears on bass and Newman Taylor Baker on drums. And then we heard, Is It Not True Simply Because You Don't Believe It? That was from Great Friends recording. Yeah. I'm sort of rushed because I need to get out of here and make room for La Nueva Alternativa, who I don't see yet. But Sonny Fortune on alto sax, Billy Harper on tenor sax, Stanley Cowell on piano, and Reggie Workman on bass, Billy Hart on drums. And behind us we're listening to, as I mentioned, The Core from Freddie Hubbard's The Core from the Cookers' first release, Warriors. Billy Harper, tenor sax, Eddie Henderson, trumpet, David Weiss on trumpet, Craig Handy on alto sax, flute on other recordings, George Cables on piano, Cecil McBee on bass, and Billy Hart on drums. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar My Bowl will be back on June 19th. Hopefully. Stay tuned.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.